Like to call the meeting of House Judiciary to order. It is 1:06 p.m. on Tuesday, April 14th. Present with us today, Representative Klayman, Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg, Vice Chair Keller, and myself, Chair Ledoux. I'll remind everybody to silence their cell phones. We have two bills before us today, SB 5, sponsored by Senator Michicki, and HB 126, a judiciary bill establishing an Alaska Code of Military Justice. We'll begin with SB 5. It looks like we have Senator Michicki here and with his staff. So if you'd like to come up and present your bill and introduce your staff member.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing this bill today. I have with me my crack staffer, Chuck Kopp, and we're here to present Senate Bill 5.
You can proceed.
Okay, thank you. Senate Bill 5 strengthens Alaska restitution laws. It helps restore crime victims to a pre-offense condition, and it protects the property of interest of all Alaskans. According to the Department of Public Safety's annual report, Crime in Alaska 2013, Alaskans suffered over $23 million in loss due to property crimes, up more than 12% from 2011. A fundamental component of restorative justice is found in court-ordered restitution and how our justice system makes crime victims whole. Senate Bill 5 addresses a language inconsistency in Alaska statutes that speaks to restitution as a provision of sentencing and as a provision of probation, which can result in persons and businesses affected by crime not receiving just compensation for loss of victim and restitution orders. Senate Bill 5 reconciles this inconsistency under one standard of restitution. It amends restitution as a provision of sentencing, adding a public policy consideration that calls for offenders to compensate victims for damages and injury, including loss of income. It defines loss of income as a total loss of income a business or person may lose due to not having stolen property available for a period of time it takes to replace that property. It adds new language directing the courts in making determinations of loss for restitution to value property as the market value of the property at the time and place of the crime, or if this cannot be reasonably ascertained, the cost of replacement within a reasonable time after the crime. And finally, Senate Bill 5 amends as a condition of probation, establishing the same standard as in AS 1255045 and restitution as a condition of sentence. The current inconsistency in our restitution laws contributed to a recent Alaska appellate court decision that is problematic to Alaskans and their property interests. In Welsh versus State of Alaska, the court decided that restitution orders as a condition of sentencing or probation would be restricted to actual damages or loss suffered by the victim, and not consider market value of the property or loss of income to the crime victim. So an example, and this is something that was brought to my attention, in my district, and this is also common in the Valley, we have a rash of drug-related crimes where folks are looking for money for additional drugs. In my district, there was a water well, small company-owned water well drilling company. Some folks broke in one night and literally trashed that vehicle for all of the copper on board, the welding leads, all the wiring harnesses. Well, they were out of business for weeks, and they're you know, the part of the season where they have the highest amount of activity. And the way the law stands, the courts are instructed to consider loss of income in restitution. Senate Bill 5 reconciles that inconsistency in our restitution orders and makes it clear in the law that we consider loss of income to be a real loss to persons and businesses that the court should consider in determination of restitution orders. I observe the rights of perpetrators, but I just happen to protect the rights of victims just a bit higher. And I believe in just and fair restitution orders from our courts. Senate Bill 5 is a substantial step in that direction. I ask that you join me in strengthening Alaska's restitution laws, restoring crime victims to a pre-offense condition, and protecting the property interests of all Alaskans. We have many letters from supporters, businesses, and individuals, and I'll stick around for questions and hand it off to Mr. Kopp.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Michiki. Section 1 of the bill clearly states a public policy preference that the court consider loss of income in issuing restitution orders. In Section 2, a new definition for loss of income is added that specifies that this includes the total loss of income a business or person suffers as a result of not having this property available for the period of time it takes to replace that property. Section 3 directs the courts making determinations of loss for restitution to value property as the market value at the time and place of the crime, or if that cannot be easily ascertained, the cost of replacement. And this is taken, Madam Chair, directly from our Title 11 criminal statutes, where the courts determine value under the criminal law for property. So it's the same language, commonality, and statute there. And finally, Madam Chair, Section 4 speaks to conditions of restitution as a provision of probation, and it makes amended language so that it is consistent with conditions of restitution for sentencing, stating that the court will determine the amount of actual damages or loss under this paragraph by valuing property as the market value of the property at the time and place of the crime, or if it cannot reasonably ascertain the cost of replacement of the property within a reasonable time after the crime. So it brings in line the provisions of restitution under sentencing and the provisions of restitution under probation so that the standard is the same and the court in both circumstances can consider the loss of income to businesses and persons in determining restitution orders. It's not mandatory. It just the law declares that the court will consider this. And as the senator said, the retail value in many cases is properly recognized as the replacement cost, and additionally it's not just the item stolen, but it's the cost of project delays and project cancellation, even sometimes for jobs that are off the road system. It can cost the season and cause liquidated damages to start, depending on what's stolen from the job site, how long it takes to replace that property. So you will see from the businesses that have supported this as broad-based support from businesses and persons across Alaska. And that, Madam Chair, is it in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for either Senator Michiki or Mr. Kopp? Representative Gernberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks to me like the bill does two things. The first is it deals with loss of income. The second deals with the valuation of the property. Through the chair, am I right in that?
Through the chair, yes, Mr. Gernberg, yes.
I ask the panel, I don't care who.
Yeah, yeah.
That was Mr. Kopp. May I continue, please?
You may continue.
I don't have any questions about the first issue. The second, several things. First, it requires the court to value the property at that amount. Using that standard. It's somewhat different than the first part of the bill, which just requires the court to take into account the loss of income. Is it your intent to require the court to use that measure of value? The reason I'm saying that is because there are different methods of valuing property. And this comes up in family law, for example. One method is the cost of replacement, that's one method. Another method, if it's income-producing property, to value it in that method, which is an income-producing of the property that was stolen, which would be similar to what you're doing in the first part of the bill. The other method is not replacement, but you look at how what similar properties are valued. You may have something that's destroyed. For example, somebody goes out and shoots a prized animal or something, and you couldn't really replace it, but you'd look and see what the similar animals would be valued at. And it seems to me, and this is just my thinking, that you might want to give the judges discretion in how to do that. And I'm just kind of giving you some thoughts, if I may, Madam Chair. Let me ramble for a minute before I ask my question, which would be your comments on this. The one thing is whether they shall value them at that, whatever measure you choose. Secondly, and this is sort of just grammatical stuff now. If you look at line 16 and again down on lines 28 and 29, they say value property as the market value. I think it should be at the market value. That would be the term. And it's twice. You can see it both on line 16 and 28. And connected with that, the term that's normally used at the law is the fair market value. So I would recommend that you use the term as it's normally used. So it would say at the fair market value. And those are just kind of grammatical things that I'm saying. And my final comment on this, if I may, is one of the really harsh rules is if you're insured and your car gets totaled, they do it on some basis that is not the replacement cost, but much less. And I don't know exactly how that relates to this, but that's always seemed to me very unfair, and I don't think that would come in.
Representative Bloomberg, how does that relate to this bill at all?
I don't know that it does.
Then can we stick to things that relate to this bill?
You're always admonishing me. Yeah, certainly. Anyway, I thought that was so unfair for a long time.
Do a bill.
Maybe we should. Okay, anyway, my question on the first and second points. Thank you for your latitude.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we're not dictating the method of valuation. The language is permissive. I think each case will differ due to particular circumstances. So I'll give you sort of what I have in mind and sort of what we believe the bill says is we live in Alaska. I mean, not everyone can go down to Costco and purchase a new generator. They may have purchased the Costco generator at Costco and may have shipped it across on a, $2,000 flight across the inlet or something. Someone comes along in a boat, steals a generator, they're caught. Well, they don't owe the victim for a $1,000 generator. They owe the victim for a $3,000 generator, and we want the courts to consider the actual cost of that object at that site at the time. We believe it's permissive enough to not steer the courts on how they're going to evaluate or value each item, but we do want that actual value to be considered.
Madam Chair, then I think we need to say that in the bill, because the way this is written now requires them to value it. And if you want to say shall consider valuation, we should add that language just like we have at the beginning of the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this issue came up in the other body, and the language on line 15 of page 1 is clearly permissive. It says, in determining the amount and method of payment of restitution or compensation, the court shall take into account. That does not tell the court.
I have the wrong version.
No, you have the right version. It's on line 15 of page 1.
Oh, page 1, yes. Yeah. But that, Madam Chair, that's there. That deals with loss of income. This other, it deals with the damage or loss for restitution.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that whole section deals with restitution with respect to restitution orders and in sentencing. And that is a predecessor to Section 2. So it is permissive. And it just says there, like if you look at the first section, that our public policy favors requiring criminals to compensate for damages and injury, including loss of income. And to further alleviate your concern, loss of income is internally consistent in that section. It's actually stated later on in that same section with respect to someone who might steal commercial fishing gear. If it's set net gear, drift gill net gear, or trolling gear, that the courts will consider loss of income in that consideration. Again, consider loss of income. So the reference to considering is consistent, taking into account is consistent throughout the statute, and it's something that is not a new concept. It's highlighting it as a public policy priority that we would like the courts to consider that.
Representative Bloomberg, the time for amendments has passed. I am not going to slow down this bill at the end of the session for an amendment which could have been made and been introduced to this committee, like the rule says, 24 hours in advance.
I just would point out that I don't believe that this sub O is limited to loss of income. Maybe I'm wrong, but this would appear to be if you lost a piece of property, some kind of piece of property that was not involved with income, but would be something like a piece of furniture or something like that. I don't think it's just limited, as you say.
Thank you. Do you have any further comments to make, either Senator Michiki or Mr. Kopp?
Madam Chair, with respect to market value, it's a well-defined term in the criminal law in Section 1146980. We did pass this out to the committee. It's the same standard the courts use now identically to determine property valuation with respect to thefts and burglary in our property crimes.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
And I appreciate that this bill actually tries to get some additional clarification. It's always interesting. I'm just interested in your observations about how this bill would play in that. I guess this, as a statistical matter, the public defender would tell us that 80 or 85% of the criminal defendants are public defender eligible, and so they usually don't have a lot of money in their pocket. And I'm just wondering, does this change the court's kind of fundamental obligation to make a determination about ability to pay or set restitution schedules consistent with how much money they actually can earn? Because I, on the one hand, I'm a 100% supporter of restitution, but I also don't really like the idea that we're going to create debtors' prisons or get people getting sent back to prison because they, you know, I mean, that comes to mind about many years ago, fairly well-publicized theft by embezzlement from a nonprofit that owed, I think, over $600,000, and the practical reality was that for all the probation in the world, they weren't going to get all their money back, and didn't make sense to have that person do more jail time just because they couldn't pay. And so I'm just curious, how does this impact, if at all, that kind of whole obligation of the ability to pay?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, it's already Alaska law that the defendant may not be in prison solely because of the inability to pay under AS 1255051A and C. And so here's my vision of how this would work, and I believe this will be up to the courts to determine. Many people that are perpetrators of a crime really have no idea what the ultimate value of the damage may be, and they go to prison for a few months. My goal is to get them out of prison as soon as possible, have them turn their lives around, but to get put on a reasonable payment plan to where they can provide the restitution to those that they have violated. And just to go further, in 1255051, it says that if at a hearing under this subsection the defendant proves by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant will be unable through good faith efforts to satisfy the order requiring payment of the fine or restitution, the court shall modify the order so the defendant can pay the fine or restitution through good faith efforts. So there's no potential for a debtor's prison in Alaska law, and there'd really be no value to the victim to have them imprisoned, even if you're retrieving cents on the dollar. To me, it largely represents the fact that we expect to every ability of the perpetrator to do their best to provide restitution to the victim.
Yeah. And then just one follow-up. I actually thought your example about the generator that say you can buy a new one at Costco for $3,000, and if the generator's been running for about 10 years before it gets stolen, the likelihood is that the old generator might be worth less than $500, but the practical reality of getting a 10-year-old generator to replace it with is pretty hard to imagine. So this bill would essentially allow the court to kind of look at the hard realities and say, well, you know, that was a 10-year-old generator. I recognize that you can't really get a used 10-year-old generator and just do dollar for dollar, and in this situation the real loss is the price of a new generator, and that would be the restitution where there really wasn't something available. In contrast, say a 5-year-old car in which there's plenty of, say, 5-year-old Fords available, nobody's going to get a brand new Ford as the value when there's actually a market and reasonably available vehicles in the same way.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, I mean, you have to have faith that common sense will prevail, right? But just might have to tell you that I had a 1942 U.S. Motors at my cabin generator until about 4 years ago, and it ran like a top until it didn't. So I would expect that the restitution would be a generator that provided a similar level of reliability and electrical capacity or something like that. You know, I would hope that most of our judges would have the common sense for a fair judgment restitution.
I would agree. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, then, if there are no other questions at the moment, then I'm going to open up public testimony. And it looks like we have online Chris Nettles. Mr. Nettles, do you want to identify yourself for the record and tell us whom you're representing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the Judiciary Committee. My name is Chris Nettles. I am president of Geotech Alaska in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the support for the National Federation of Independent Business and as a principal owner of my business. I want to also particularly thank Senator McKitchen for the attempt to strengthen the restitution laws. After having read some of this and heard some of the testimony and written regarding the sort of the misunderstanding that these laws as they are now can do, I want to say how important it is to a business that we have strengthened restitution laws, and that certainly more than just the market value or even the just the cost of the equipment or whatever has been done, damage, etc. As an example, we've been doing jobs out in the off-the-road system all over Alaska. We do work from anywhere from the North Slope all the way down to the southeast and out on the Aleutian Islands. When you go out to do a job, in our case, an example was a snow machine was taken out to an off-road site, and it was stolen. But fortunately, it was stolen after the project had been completed. But however, if that snow machine had been stolen before the project, we would not only have had just the cost of replacing the snow machine, we would have the cost of getting it back out there to the site, which can be expensive flight time, etc., with airplane transportation. And then you may also, because of contracts, may be under some sort of liability or loss because of not meeting the contract time, because you have other people like your clients that are out there also waiting for this project to get completed, and they may have to be on standby, so we may actually incur the standby cost for something like that happening. So when we look at the cost of an item or some damage done by someone, it's not just the cost of the project or not just the cost for that item. There are lots of other costs that can come into it for just one item, but that's essential to a project. So, I appreciate you taking the time to hear it, and I appreciate Senator McKitchen for trying to strengthen these laws. It is crucial to a small business that there be some way of getting restitution, if we can, from the perpetrators. So, thank you again.
Thank you again. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Nettles? All right. Again, thank you, Mr. Nettles. Is there anybody else online? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing none, we will... Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, I still have a question about the legal interpretation that...
Do you have the question for Mr. Nettles or for anybody doing public testimony?
No, this would be for an attorney.
Okay, well, there is no attorney, so...
Maybe somebody from legal counsel or something.
All right, well, we're going to close public testimony. There is somebody here from the court system that we can...
That's
fine. So, Ms. Mead?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I'm here just for questions.
Ms. Mead, through the chair. My question relates back to my conversation with Mr. Kopp a minute ago. And what I was concerned about was in Section 3 and 4, 3 of the bill and then 4, which deals with probation. I believe that subsection O, which is going to be added in Section 3, would not be limited to a determination of loss of income, which, as we have at the bottom of page 1, requiring the court to take that into account. It looks to me like the new subsection O would not be permissive, but would require the court to value the property at the fair market value. Do you agree?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the legal interpretation of the bill is, as you know, something that the court system does not normally provide. That would be a better question for your legal counsel. I will say that from the court system's point of view, this does clarify how to apply some formerly currently inconsistent statutes, and I believe it's something that the court can easily apply. At restitution hearings, there are already now arguments and discussion brought forth about valuation of property. With this bill, there's more guidance for the court, which is something the judges appreciate, and I do believe it clarifies some inconsistencies, and I don't see a problem with courts applying it as written. And I don't know if that's helpful or responsive to your question.
Not entirely.
Well, we also have Casey Schroeder here. Do you want to hear from
sure,
Casey?
Sure, yeah, that'd be fine.
She was trying to... She was reading carefully.
I realized it was an unfair question to the court system.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Can you briefly restate the question?
Yeah. Focusing on Section 3 of the bill. The question is whether that subsection would only apply to property involved in loss of income. The way I read it, it is a standalone section that's under restitution and compensation, AS 1255-045, not all of which involves income-producing property or property involved in the loss of income. So let us say that a piece of furniture or a car or something that was not involved in income-producing was valued, sub O would apply. In other words, sub O applies to income-producing situations, but also to non-income-producing situations, I think. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I read sub O as applying to the entire statute and not being limited and clarifying how the court should value property.
Yeah, that was what my problem was, that it's not just a factor to be taken into consideration, But in a non-income situation, the court would have to value it at that method. And I'm not saying that's all bad, but I'm saying there may be other ways that the court would want to have some leeway.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Thank you. Did you have any question?
No, that's what I was just going to point out. That isn't necessarily bad. This applies to all restitution compensation. So.
Right. Thank you very much, Ms. Schroeder. So do we have any more questions for the presenters, the sponsors of the bill?
No.
Any further committee discussion? It is my intention to move this bill today. So I want to take, though, however, a brief at ease. So we were actually discussing whether or not this is a grammatical error here on line 16 and line 28. Shall value property as the market value of the property or as the market, etc. And I gather the sponsor doesn't believe that that's a grammatical error.
I don't believe, Madam Chair. If you read the whole sentence, the court shall value property. So you're taking the value, those two words, and you're valuing it as the market value of the property. So at the market value of the property, you would be looking at one singular item. So this is just saying it's valued as the market value of the property. I don't see it as a grammatical error. I think it fits. I think it went through the Department of Law. It went through Ledge Legal. They agree that that's the way it should read, and I'm for all intents and purposes, it's fully functioning as written.
And I'm not a grammarian, so I can live with it. Any other comments or questions?
Just thank you for a good bill. Can I move the bill?
You can move the bill.
I would move SB 5. We pass it from committee with version H, that is, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the bill moves, and stick around to sign the report.
Thank you.
We are back on record again. So the next item on the agenda is HB 126, which relates to establishing an Alaska State Code of Military Justice. And we have presenting is my House Judiciary aide, my staffer Thomas Brown, and we also have Lieutenant Forrest Dunbar of the Alaska National Guard here to present this bill. Mr. Brown, Lieutenant Dunbar, please put yourselves on the record and brief the committee on HB 126.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Thomas Brown, staff to Representative Ledoux. I'm going to give a brief overview of the bill, walk you through the sectional analysis, and then hand the proceedings off to First Lieutenant Dunbar to give you a better overview. House Bill 126.
And we're dealing with version E?
Version E, yes, ma'am. House Bill 126.
Version A here, Madam Chair. Oh, no, I'm looking. I guess that's a different bill. It must be. Sorry.
Okay, House Bill 126. House Bill 126 is legislation crafted at the request of Alaska's military command. They asked for a greater authority and latitude in pursuing and prosecuting those service members who violated military rules and protocols. The version you see before you is a synthesis of a separate bill presented by Minority Leader Representative Tuck. That bill sought the same ends as this bill, as the original House Bill 126, but it came at it from a different, by different means. House Bill 126 sought to achieve, to give the authority to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and allow them to create regulations to govern themselves. House Bill 121, Representative Tuck's bill, sought to do the same, but sought to do it in statute as opposed to regulation. Lieutenant Dunbar will walk you through the fine points of that, but the section analysis before you lays out the result of that synthesis.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have received a copy of the pages from Tuck's bill, pages 44 through 54. Do the other members have this? Oh, okay. At some point, this is what you sent me. At some point, I think we should have that in front of us. But my question was, where did this language come from?
For the record, this is Forrest Dunbar, First Lieutenant with the Alaska Army National Guard. Representative Greenberg, I sent that to you in your office after our meeting. That language came primarily, I believe, actually I'm certain, from the State Model Code, which is created by the National Guard Bureau.
Madam Chair, at some point are we going to have access or and have you go through with us what part of the bill we're looking at is from the code and what is not? So I mean, so we have something as a...
Well, we're not going to move this bill today, Representative Greenberg, and I'm thinking that this is a really nice project for the interim. We can all meet on this and craft the perfect BIM before we come back in January.
I didn't mean that this had to be done today. I'm just at some point.
I will say briefly, Representative Greenberg, through the chair, the vast majority of the language in this bill, HB 126, whether it was originally in HB 126 or brought across from HB 121, the vast majority of it is taken from that model code from the National Guard Bureau.
And through the chair, Representative Greenberg, to further the point, as the chair just said, we have no intention of even asking this bill to be moved out of committee today. This is a project. It's going to be over interim. We're going to be working with the department. We will craft a better, I hesitate to say perfect bill, but a better bill so that this time next year we can send the governor something that all parties involved can be, you know, content with.
We're all fans of Plato.
So, the section analysis for House Bill 126. Section 1 designates the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals over actions and proceedings in a military court. Section 2, beginning on page 2, eliminates protection from criminal liability for guard members charged with crimes resulting from their duties and clarifies that any exemption from liability will not apply to offenses under the proposed Alaska Code of Military Justice. Section 3, also on page 2, is a more conforming amendment. Section 4, this is the meat of the bill. Much of this comes actually from from Representative Tuck's bill. This is where a large chunk of that language comes from. Section 4 covers pages 2 through 36. It creates a new article, the Code of Military Justice. Of the new sections in this article, it instructs the Adjutant General to adopt regulations for a Code of Military Justice under the terms of this chapter. I'll include just the highlights because it gets into the nitty-gritty occasionally. Primarily, it provides for the organization and conduct of a court's martial, provides for a non-judicial punishment, NJP, identifies which offenses are subject to court martial or NJP, identifies allowable punishments for such offenses, identifies the rules of trial, pre-trial, post-trial, and related procedures. It organizes courts of inquiry and provides adequate protection of classified information from the general public. Other sections in Section 4, other subsections in Section 4 in this Code of Military Justice include a statement that all non-military offenses shall be tried in a civilian court. Anything that is a civilian offense shall be tried by a civilian court. If you murder someone, the Alaska Code of Military Justice does not apply. You will be tried by civilian authorities. It designates the exclusive jurisdiction of courts martial over the Code of Military Justice and that code applies to all military offenses. that sets jurisdiction of the military code over deserters and those fraudulently discharged personnel and members who commit their offenses outside of the state or happen to live outside of the state when charged with that offense. It details the duties and qualifications of those who serve as judge advocates. It defines who may apprehend members accused of a military offense and how that apprehensions to take place. It defines how a member may be arrested, under what conditions, who may do so, and how they may be confined. It defines how a member accused of a military offense may be delivered to a civilian authority. It describes the composition, duties, terms of service, jurisdictions, and convening authorities of courts martial. Lays out requirements for who may serve on courts martial. Specifies that a guardsman and specifies that a guardsman cannot be tried by a service member ranking lower than themselves. It provides the requirements for military judges in courts martial. Describes the duties and qualifications of trial counsel, defense counsel, assistant counsel, court reporters, and interpreters for courts martial. It specifies the procedures for bringing charges against a member, prevents the self-incrimination of the accused, defines the investigatory process, lays out how charges may be processed, and the procedures for continuances, oaths, and oaths of office for court officers. It defines the statutes of limitations for military offenses. It prohibits double jeopardy charges and describes how pleas of the accused are to be processed. Pardon me. Provides for an insanity defense for the accused and a determination for mental competency of the accused. It describes the procedures for voting and rulings in courts martial, requires the recordings of courts martial, describes the allowable punishments and sentences, and prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. It describes the appeals process in the military code, including appeals by the state, allows for a vacation of suspension under certain circumstances, allows for the accused to petition for a new trial and for the restoration of privileges. It describes the composition and duties of the Military Appeals Commission, defines who may administer oaths for the purposes of military administration proceedings, allows for the governor to delegate authority for the Code of Military Justice, creates a military justice account inside the general fund. Describes the system of paying and collection of fines associated with the military code. Describes the pay scale of officers and witnesses of the courts martial. Provides immunity for persons who acted pursuant to their duties under the military code. And defines the terms associated with this new article. Section 5 on page 36 further defines what held under authority of state law means. Section 6, same page, describes how persons convicted under the military code are to be restrained or confined. Section 7, same page, requires the Attorney General to assist courts martial in cases of mental incompetency. Section 8, over the next two pages, is a conforming amendment dealing with the duties of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Section 9 is the repeal section. Section 10 is the applicability clause. Section 11 establishes and describes the terms of office of the Military Appeals Commission. Section 12 authorizes the Adjutant General to enact and enforce the regulations under the Code of Military Justice upon approval of the Governor. And the next two sections are the effective dates for these for the bill. And riveting as that was, I'm going to turn this over to Lieutenant Dunbar. He's got a slideshow for you, and we'll be able to give you better answers than I could.
Thank you, Thomas. Again, for the record, my name is Forrest Dunbar. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska Army National Guard. I want to apologize to those on this committee that have already seen this exact presentation. And I've also spoken, I believe, with all of you individually about what we are attempting to do here, so I'll try to move through this quickly and get to any questions you might have. I think Tom did a very good job of framing that we are trying to create a system whereby we can effectively discipline our soldiers and airmen using the Alaska Code of Military Justice. And on behalf of the command, I just want to say I have we have really appreciated how cooperative the legislature has been. We have received an incredible amount of support on this bill, and we hope to continue to work with you over the interim. I believe also online we have Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole. I believe he is online. He can answer some questions that I might not be able to. He, in addition to his duties, he was also for a long time in the military on active duty, and he is a colonel with considerably more experience than I have. Another thing to frame this discussion very quickly, the vast majority of funding for the Alaska National Guard comes from the federal government. So in a sense, we get very good bang for our buck as a state. I myself at the moment am being paid for by the federal government because they want us to have an effective, combat-effective force, and we believe that this process of creating a new code of military justice will help us become so. So some key points just very quickly. This is probably our least aesthetically appealing slide. The Code of Military Justice will allow our commanders to administer courts-martial and convict, potentially, guardsmen of offenses. It also will give us the tools to do what's called non-judicial punishment, which is something usually for offenses more minor than those warranting court-martial, and allows for commanders to quickly discipline guardsmen using suspensions, fines, sometimes a bust in rank. This is a very useful tool that is used quite frequently in guards across the country. And this is another important point about this bill and about what we're trying to do. We are one of very few states that does not have this kind of code. Most states have these regulations and they use them to good effect. But a very important point, which Tom mentioned, but I want to emphasize, we are not trying to create a replacement judicial system that will try to convict every offense that our members potentially commit. The policy of the prior territorial guard, which is carried forward in HB 126, is that if an offense is cognizable under civilian law, so a theft, a homicide, a sexual assault, the default is that it will be prosecuted by civilian authorities, and that is the strong preference of the National Guard. We don't have our own police force. We don't have our own jails. We don't have our own specialized prosecutors to deal with things like sexual assault being the most prominent example. That being said, there may be cases where civilian authorities decline to prosecute something that the general public believes is an offense. So the most relevant example is, the most recent scandal involving the National Guard. There was some behavior by guardsmen that involved sexual relations with recruits, and the civilian authorities, for a variety of reasons, decided not to prosecute. So, for example, perhaps there wasn't enough evidence, or it didn't tightly fit the definition of sexual assault. But there are military offenses that are broad enough where we could potentially pursue some of those offenders for things like dereliction of duty, conduct on becoming an officer. There are also offenses, military offenses, things like drunk on duty and things of that nature. And those are the offenses that we are going to put into regulation if HB 126 passes. That being said, we anticipate a relatively small number of courts-martial, in the same way that most civilian cases settle before they reach trial. We anticipate that most offenses will be resolved in one way or another before we reach a full court-martial. In Washington, Oregon, they have less than one of these a year. In our fiscal note, we anticipated two a year, but that, we believe, is something approaching a sort of worst-case scenario. I'll go on to the next slide here. Again, the goal for this is good order and discipline. So you can see the three legs to this stool. Administrative actions, that's things like separation, letters of reprimand. The Alaska criminal law, which still, of course, applies to our soldiers and airmen living in the state. And the last leg of the stool, the one that we have heretofore not had available to us, is this code of military justice, which gives us the power to have courts martial and non-judicial punishment. Now, a question I've been asked a number of times during the course of this process is, had this regular stool been present prior to the activities that led to the scandal, could we have avoided those activities and that scandal? And the answer is we're not sure. There's no way to know. I think it would have increased the likelihood that we would have been able to bring good order and discipline to those units more quickly. But of course, if we don't get buy-in from our command and from our soldiers, it's just a dead letter.
Madam Chair.
Representative Goldberg?
Ask questions as he's going or wait to the end of your question?
Probably ask questions as he's going if you have a question.
Yeah,
although I was hoping, since the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, of which you and I are on, has, and Representative Lynn, that most of the questioning could be done by Representative Klayman and Representative Keller, who have not heard this bill and listened to this presentation previously. Nevertheless, if somebody who has already listened to the presentation has a question, I will entertain it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, because that was kind of a quick process in the other committee, and I know this is going to be more deliberative, and I appreciate that. I have a number of questions, but I want to focus on one thing, Lieutenant. In order to determine how well the current system works, or how well this could have worked, it may be something that this committee would consider in having an executive session or something to go into what actually occurred in the investigation previously. And I'm not doing anything more now than sort of raising that, because if we're to do that or be able to subpoena people or anything, there are certain procedures, and I don't know if those have to be done before we adjourn.
Thank you. Did you have a question for Lieutenant Dunbar?
Yes, that wasn't a question. I'm batting a zero today.
You are.
I do have a few, if I may.
Go ahead. Okay. As long as there are actually questions, Representative Greenberg.
I got them down as questions. Okay. Are the attorneys who are going to be involved in this process members of the Alaska Bar? The reason I'm asking is because if they're Alaskan attorneys largely, then they would be familiar with Alaska statutes and Alaska procedures, which will have some relevance in my following questions.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, we have attorneys, we have both. We have attorneys that are members of the Alaska Bar and ones that are not. I would say the majority are members of the Alaska Bar.
Okay. Let's assume that as we go through, we're going to find out which proposed statutes, are actually taken from the model code. Is there a body of law or a place we can look for, let's take as an example, so where the crimes are here. I'm sorry, I have it here somewhere. Yeah, let's take, for example, a typical crime, fraudulent enlistment. Is there an annotated code somewhere so we can see how courts have previously interpreted a statute like that?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, actually I'm holding in my hand such a document that is published by the National Guard Bureau. It doesn't have quite the level of detail I think you're looking for, though. It mostly just refers to the attendant regulation in the UCMJ.
Mm.
Now, the UCMJ, of course, as you know, has a fairly vast case law associated with it.
And through the chair, so if this is taken from the regulations under the code, then the lawyers who were involved will be able to see how this language has been interpreted by other courts.
Yes, Representative Greenberg, through the chair.
Number two, are we going to be informed in individual cases whether the language you're selecting here, say under this, the crimes or the offenses that they're termed, whether they are different than the model code? You're nodding. You have to speak.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair. It's a little bit later in my presentation when I describe the process by which we hope to come up with the actual code itself. I believe we will start with a baseline of the model code, and then we will, through hopefully input from this committee, but also through our chain of command and our soldiers and people we are in contact with at the Judge Advocate Legal Center and school and other guards, we hope to develop. There might be some offenses we take out, there might be some offenses we add, there might be some that we change. And I think, to your point, absolutely, we will provide guidance in a document to show where we are differing from the strict model code.
If I may continue. You have chosen a model which is a military model with the model code. On the other hand, some of these, in the offense area, some of them deal with things that are defined in Alaska Criminal Code Title 11, like attempts, solicitation, conspiracy, and stuff. And as we go through this and study this in the interim, I assume you're going to be prepared to talk not just about the genesis coming from the model code, but the alternative, if there is any difference between that and the Alaska Title 11. And that's where I come back to the question of members of the Alaska Bar, because if the members of the Alaska Bar, they're likely to be familiar, more familiar with Title 11 than the model code. Would you respond to the chair, please?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, that's a very good point. And the guard members who will be most involved in this process over the interim are members of the Alaska Bar. We will be primarily based at JBAR, and we will hope to work closely with your office on exactly those kind of questions.
I think that's all my preliminary questions.
Thank you.
Madam Mayor.
Go ahead.
So this actually goes...
I think I'm going to let Lieutenant Dunbar give his presentation before we ask any more questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I will try to get through this quickly. So this actually goes to Representative Greenberg's point, though. There is already some existing relevant law. Of course, there is the Territorial Code, Title 26 of the Alaska Statutes, but it does not establish a code of military justice. There is the Alaska State Criminal Code, which in most cases will provide for prosecutions and punishments for the most serious offenses. There's also the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is itself a fairly comprehensive criminal code and has things like homicide and theft and the like. But the federal code only applies to our guard members when they are in a fully federalized status. And statuses are a very important part of this whole puzzle. The three main statuses are, as you can see, Title 32, Title 10, and State Active Duty. Fully federalized is Title 10. When our men and women are sent to Iraq or Afghanistan or on other missions where they are in the full under the full command of the federal forces, they are in Title 10, and they are subject to the federal UCMJ. That is, again, a fairly comprehensive criminal code. However, when they are in Title 32 status, which is what I am currently on, and which most guards people are on most of the time when they are on their drill weekends, for example, they are not subject to the federal UCMJ, despite the fact that they are paid for, usually, by the federal government. So they are paid by the federal government, but they are commanded by the governor and by the state and by the Adjutant General. So they are not subject to the federal UCMJ. State active duty, typically for disaster response, and again, not subject to the federal UCMJ. They are commanded by the state and they are paid for by the state. This is a sort of graphical representation of that. there is a gap in our law at the moment. Military offenses cannot be prosecuted at the moment. We don't have the appropriate laws to prosecute our Guards members for military offenses when they are on Title 32 or state active duty. And this means that certain things are unavailable to us. For example, dishonorable discharge. We cannot, and we have never, dishonorably discharged a member of the Alaska National Guard using our own state law. The worst we can do is what's called other than honorable characterization of service. And there are times, and perhaps some of the behavior that led to the scandal recently, where other than honorable discharge is not sufficient, where a dishonorable discharge might be more appropriate. And that's one of the tools we would like to have available to us that you can give to us by passing this statute. Again, we're trying to maintain good order and discipline. I think we've gone over that pretty thoroughly. Here, again, are the five primary tools we use to enforce good order and discipline. Administrative actions, administrative separation, and Alaska criminal law are all currently available to us, but non-judicial punishment and courts martial are not. So our plan of action now. This bill, as Tom said, is a synthesis between HB 121 and HB 126. It was joined together in the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. There were several other amendments that we, the Guard, asked for to expand the kind of soldiers and airmen that can be involved on courts martial. And again, that gets to the resource constraints that we have in the Guard. We are a small Guard with relatively few judge advocate and other legal resources. And so we need to be able to draw upon other Guards and the active duty components that exist in this state. So we have HB 126. It's now going forward, and we hope to work over the interim with this committee to hammer out some of the details. But as it stands now, this is a good bill. If this bill were to pass unaltered, we believe it would lead to a functioning system of military justice. However, we believe it can be refined in a number of ways, and we hope to work with you over the interim to do so. We also, because of the sort of philosophical difference that Tom described, this bill empowers us to create substantive offenses in regulation and an NJP regulation instead of putting them in statute. That was the preference of our command. And over the course of the interim, we hope to draw upon our commanders and some of our more junior soldiers and get their advice and their input on to what that should look like. And then we hope in the late fall, early winter to bring that to you and to other members of this body and say, if you pass this statute, these are the regulations that we hope to adopt. And we will try to stress test those in our own ways over the summer as well. So with that, I'll just open it up to questions and again say thank you for the work that we've already done and the meetings we've already had with members of this committee.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Klingman, do you have any questions?
No.
Representative Keller? No. Representative Grunberg?
I do want to, though, thank Lieutenant Dunbar. He came by my office. We had a long visit, talked in a lot of detail, which is part of the reason why I'm comfortable knowing that we'll have opportunities in the months ahead to look at this as the process moves forward, and I have great confidence in that process, and I broadly support exactly what we're doing.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time you spent with me, too, and we focused on some things where we may differ, but I don't want you to think that that's most of this. Going back to your Venn diagrams, can you put that back up? Yeah, there we go. Somebody chose to do a middle ground there. Although as a practical matter, most of the serious offenses and the stuff that's criminal under our state law will remain with the state. Why didn't you say we will take the Uniform Code of Military Justice except for the following? And you carve out a few things, but basically then you have a well-developed, already existing body of law with a lot of reported decisions, and we could just see where it wouldn't fit in Alaska, and as far as the interface between that and Title 11, we now have a statute that says normally if it's a civilian crime, it goes to the civilian authorities. But that would provide, we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. And also, it would, frankly, that's all I want to say, we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. Was there a reason that it would be a lot easier to do, too?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. So it is our intention not to reinvent the wheel. However, perhaps we are taking a slightly different wheel than the UCMJ. We are going to draw more upon other states and what other states have done. And they have taken much of what they have done from the National Guard Bureau, which, as you know, is distinct from the active duty component. Now, National Guard Bureau itself does some synthesis and only takes out parts of the federal UCMJ. And as you know, the federal UCMJ itself is going through a sort of state of flux right now, and there's a number of rather large changes that have happened recently in the federal UCMJ. So I believe it was our, again, it's not our intention to reinvent the wheel at all, but the federal UCMJ doesn't directly apply in all cases for a variety of reasons. I would say with this bill in particular, there are some things that are specific to Alaska that we talked a little bit about in the prior committee. The most prominent example is the state model code and the federal UCMJ says you only need to have two-thirds of a panel convict you to have a conviction in a courts martial. We believe the Alaska Constitution provides a stronger right to a unanimous jury verdict, and so we changed the law to provide that unanimous right to a panel decision to our Guards members. And we think that's appropriate to the state law. But again, to get back to your question, I believe that the drafters of HB 121 in particular, Representative Tuck's prior bill, and HB 126, they drew a lot of their language from that state model code from the National Guard Bureau rather than directly from the UCMJ, and we do believe that's appropriate. Now, some other places where we are going to differ, the state model code itself is not perfect and has some things we think that are a little bit archaic, and you know, the best example being dueling. We might keep the offense of dueling, but there's a good chance that we think that won't be necessary. And if there are other offenses that might be more appropriate, and we hope to find those offenses and develop those offenses over the course of the interim. I'll also say that we are in contact now with a particular major who is sort of a, within the context of the JAG world, a legal academic at the JAG Legal Center and School, and her students are doing exactly this process and looking for ways to update the federal UCMJ, but we think also the state codes in a way that makes them more relevant for the modern era.
I think this is something we can talk about as it goes along, but I see potentially four different things. The federal UCMJ, the state general UCMJ that the other states are using, our thing, and then Title 11. And I'm just going to be interested in how we do this.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Now, I'm a little bit concerned of leaving so much to the regulations. I think I might feel more comfortable working on this over the interim, putting the basics actually into statute, and then things that perhaps are more peripheral, letting those be done through regulations. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't want to leave the committee with the impression right now that there isn't a lot of substantive law in the current statute. It is I think, 39-page bill or something like that now. There are a lot of constraints already in this bill, in your bill. But we are certainly appreciative of the notion that our ability to create substantive offenses is a considerable municipality we're being entrusted to. I will point to some other states. Oregon, I think, is the one we drew on most closely. Oregon does it that way, through regulation. But I have spoken with Representative Greenberg about a review process, and I think that's something that we would be very we would hope to work with members of this body on, that if we are creating these kind of substantive regulations, that there is some form of legislative review.
Because right now, the way it is worded, it's not even subject to the Administrative Procedure Act. So basically, we're just giving the guard carte blanche, and I think that there may be some discomfort in that.
Madam Chair, I think you are correct. I wouldn't characterize it as carte blanche. I think there are a number of constraints already in the bill. It is true that we are being given more regulatory authority over our own guards people than other agencies typically get over theirs or over the general public. And I think there are fairly good reasons for that. We swear oaths to uphold the Constitution and also follow every general command. I think the degree to which our commanders can already sort of regulate our soldiers and airmen through orders that are generally applicable, I think would surprise some people. I mean, you can put out an order that says, don't do this broadly. An order doesn't have to be directly to a guardsman. But that being said, I think this is definitely the kind of dialogue we plan to have over the interim. And I understand why some representatives want to hear very clearly why we want to do it this way. And perhaps what Representative Greenberg and I had spoken about before is, if we were to apply the full Administrative Procedures Act to all the regulations that we do, that would likely delay the implementation of these regulations for a considerable amount of time. And we would like to have a functioning code of military justice as soon as possible, at some point, either during or shortly after the next session. But for those regulations and changes to the regulations thereafter, it might be that we want to have a more thorough regulatory review process. This is exactly the conversation I think that we would like to have with the interim.
I guess what I'm thinking about is that the first group of regulations be actually adopted into statute, because by then we've all gone through them, we've all vetted them, so you actually put those into statute, and then perhaps the next group doesn't have to be in statute, but there needs to be a vetting process for it.
Madam Chair, I think this time I can. I think one of the concerns of the guard is if we put something into statute initially, and we realize it's not workable, will it be difficult to come back and get a revision? And this gives us sort of the flexibility to change things a little more quickly.
But that's the case. I mean, we deal with that sort of thing here all the time. We pass a law, and then if it's not working out the way we want it to work out, that's what the next session is for.
Yes. Absolutely. This is a conversation we should continue to have.
And again, for the record, this is Donald Brown. And Madam Chair, it should be noted on record that while this would be giving greater regulatory authority to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs than other agencies or departments generally get, when those other agencies and departments craft regulations, they're crafting them for everyone in the state. Alaskan residents, visitors, period. What the department is asking for is the authority to police the 4,000 people who volunteered and swore oaths. This is not... It's not... I really suggest they're not compatible situations, and that extra element needs to be taken into account as part of this greater conversation.
Representative Greenberg?
Generally, I agree. But I got to say, that ain't always true. How about APOC? And we had talked, Lieutenant and I, about what you're talking about, Madam Chair, that the initial stuff is by statute, but then thereafter the department could do regulations under the APA, which would be the rulemaking provisions in the APA, quasi-legislative, which requires notice to the general public, opportunity to comment as necessary, but it would still come in to the department. So the department would evaluate anything, and then it would come back to the legislature with reports so we could see if there's a problem. I want to try to accommodate both of you, because I think we can. And I'm largely with both of you, actually.
Thank you. Representative Kleinman.
I just would, I think one of the things that I talked with Lieutenant Dunbar about was kind of, if you might think of it as somewhat of a hybrid approach between the two, which would be the idea that the department proposes regulations, and then those regulations are essentially put up for the legislature to adopt kind of on an up or down basis. But if we don't like it, we send them back to the drawing board, but we don't try to get too involved in the idea of specific language and specific statutes or regulations, but that they were actually asked on a regular basis to look at what they've come up with and give our stamp of approval. But rather than trying to become complete experts in military justice, that we're asked to look at it as a whole and then give it an approval so that it does get legislative review. And if we're not happy with the thing as a whole, we send it back, but we don't get too caught up in a lot of detailed amendments, which we sometimes are sometimes overly capable of.
A response to that, having served as joint chair of the regulation committee, that does not work well. It gets just ignored. You know, it's just a simple waste of time, in my opinion. You know, so it seems like we're engaged or not, but. It's how many regulation notices have you gotten to me during session? And frankly, I confess, I don't get through the details like I sure wish I could on those.
I was actually just describing something a little different than just regulatory review, that we actually put it in, that the whole code come before us specifically for specific review in a little bit more systematic manner than we get with regulations that show up from time to time.
Representative Linder?
Yeah, I think, I'm thinking somewhat of the same line, that they would submit it to us, and frankly, the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee could, it specializes in this, could look, or Judiciary.
Well, as I say, we have the entire interim to work on this. If we have no more questions for Mr. For Thomas or Lieutenant Dunbar, I think we've scheduled public testimony today. Yeah. Is anybody online? So, open up public testimony. Is there anybody online? We have Bob Dole for questioning. Would anybody like to ask?
I do have one question.
All right, go ahead.
I'm Mr. Dole. This is Max Greenberg. Can you hear me?
Through the chair, yes, I can, Representative Greenberg.
Did you have any direct experience while you were in the service dealing with the code?
Through the chair, yes, I did. As a commander, utilizing the code for actions necessary to maintain good order and discipline, where it could be used and was appropriate for a formal court-martial versus non-judicial punishment.
Okay, I just kind of wanted to have that on the record. I don't want to pursue that.
Thank you. Representative Keller?
The question I have, probably the answer is real forward, and I missed it here. I mean, this could be for Mr. Dole or you, but what about when you're on active duty for training? Is that a separate category that's addressed differently, or what would be the status of a person who's active duty for training, like they have brief stints of 2 weeks?
Deputy Commissioner Dole, I think you might be able to answer that question, but could you please put yourself on the record?
Sorry about that. Through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Bob Dulles from the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Through the chair, Representative Keller, generally an individual on active duty for training is under Title 32, meaning that they do not come under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the federal one, rather they are under state law.
Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Representative Keller?
No.
Any further questions for Commissioner Dole? All right, thank you very much. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Well, then we will close public testimony for now, but we will open it up again when we hear the bill in January. Do we have any more questions for Mr. Brown or Lieutenant Dunbar, or is there any comments from the committee? All right. Well, as I said, I'm going to hold this bill. We'll work on it during the interim. I really appreciate all of the work that both of you have done on this bill, and I think we have our marching orders, so to speak. So it is 2:32 right now. I'm going to adjourn this meeting. We have one more meeting of House Judiciary, and that is tomorrow at 1 o'clock.